This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, remembering the late Illinois Congressman Lane Evans. A new book examines his life and career. Maybe you've seen the movie The Green Book. In Springfield, there's a new museum which looks at what life was like for African Americans traveling Route 66. We'll take a visit. A suburban school district that has been working to overcome issues related to racial insensitivity. We'll find out more. As of January 1st, recreational marijuana will be legal in Illinois. College campuses are also getting ready, although some of them will still enforce rules.
You could face a fine. You could be ordered to do a substance use program so that you understand the impact.
And for those who want to purchase marijuana, what will that be like and how much will it cost? We'll get some answers about the new marijuana law. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll talk about marijuana. The state's new law allowing adult recreational use takes effect in a couple of weeks. We'll find out how a producer is trying to meet demand and how some colleges plan to address legalization. Later, we discuss the life and career of the late Illinois Congressman Lane Evans with the author of a new biography. That and more this hour. Starting January 1st, marijuana possession will be legal in Illinois, making it the 11th state to approve recreational use of the plant. Though officials expect strong demand when retail sales start, there are still questions about the new law that linger. Reporter Maureen McKinney reached out to several experts for some answers, and Sam Dunklaw talked with her about what she learned.
Maureen, a lot of folks that we've heard from, whether here in Illinois or out of state, like this listener in Tennessee, have asked about the basics of this new marijuana law.
There have been some questions about how much we could buy, how much flower, or this, that, and the other. Could you give us some information about that?
So you can possess 30 grams, which is about an ounce, and if you're from out of state, you get to possess half that. It's adult use only, and it's not allowed outdoors. Like Toy Hutchinson said, there are folks worried about having to walk through clouds of smoke, and that's not going to happen. The only places allowed to have recreational smoking are businesses like hookah lounges or the dispensaries if they set aside an area for smoking.
And Tory Hutchinson, we should remind our listeners, was one of the main sponsors of the legislation, who was in the state Senate at the time that it passed and is now the Pritzker administration's so-called cannabis czar.
Right.
How many businesses are going to be allowed? Do we know the number of retail dispensaries that there are going to be come January 1st and how that's going to roll out?
At least for January 1, there are about 30, and they have to be already medical dispensaries. And there are applications out now for the recreational dispensaries, and those are going to be awarded in the spring. I think the decision comes out January 2nd.
Something, too, that we've looked into or you've looked into in talking to some folks is whether or not demand will exceed the availability of the product, and product being things like marijuana flower, the more traditional sort of bud-looking stuff, the oils, the extracts, that kind of thing. Is there going to be enough when people start lining up January 1st?
Right. Probably not. It really sounds like there will literally be lines as soon as they open. And I talked to Dan Lynn, who is the former head of Illinois' National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Laws, and is now a dispensary manager at two locations. He expects demand to be so high that prices will be crazy, like as high as $600, depending on the quality of the strain. The legal market, he says, is going to be so high, and the price is so high that there are probably going to be people who aren't satisfied with the prices in the legal market and will turn to the non-legal.
This is a market that has existed for decades illegally. There's plenty of people in that traditional market, as they call it, who are happy and satisfied with the producers and distributors that they're already making these purchases from.
A lot of folks at public universities, private universities around the state are interested in this. Can you consume your legal marijuana product on like a campus, for example?
Probably not, because colleges are able to make whatever rules they want to stop cannabis use on campus.
Illinois, of course, is not the only state to have legalized marijuana. But what makes Illinois' law really different than anyone else's?
The social equity component that really works to expunge the records of individuals who were caught up in the war on drugs that disproportionately affected minority communities.
You talked to former State Senator Toy Hutchinson, who's now Illinois' cannabis czar, about that. She, from what I understand, says that that's a crowning achievement.
We had a governor who believed in it, and we had bill sponsors and drafters who gave everything they possibly could to make sure that if we were going to normalize and legalize this activity, that you could not do that at the same time as not paying attention to the communities that it hurt the most during Prohibition. To think of it any other way would be fundamentally unfair.
Of course, Illinois is the 11th state to allow recreational marijuana to be legalized, and the first one that did it legislatively. And it was important to those lawmakers to include that social equity component.
The law enforcement community, as well as the business community, have been opponents to this initially. But I'm wondering what you've heard from the business community specifically about whether or not they're concerned that they're going to have a lot of high workers starting to stream into their workplaces.
Right. From what I've heard, I talked to Todd Meisch, who's ahead of the State Chamber of Commerce, and he says that the law has really strong policies on the ability of companies to drug test.
There are a lot of businesses, many, many businesses, where safety and even federal law require absolute drug-free workplaces. We believe that the law that's in place guarantees that.
Maureen, I want to get back to the concerns about the law enforcement community. You spoke to one particular person from that area. Can you tell us what he said?
Yeah, that was Ed Wojcicki, who is the executive director of the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police. And he said there were concerns about safety. For instance, you've got to be careful consuming edibles. They'd seen in out of state that there were people who got too high because they had an edible they weren't used to. The high, it's really fast with the flower, but in terms of edibles, it may take longer and they may get so high they get sick. That was one of his concerns. And the other was a warning, what you can and can't possess in your car. You can't carry it in a baggie. You've got to have it in an odorless, colorless shield.
That's Maureen McKinney talking with Sam Dunklaw about Illinois' new marijuana law set to take effect New Year's Day. You can find out more answers to questions you may have about the law. We have a link at our website at statewideshow.com. Peter Medlin now takes a look at how the law will play out at some of the state's university campuses.
On a recent Thursday, a small group of Northern Illinois University students took their seats at an open forum to discuss recreational marijuana. And administrators wanted to make one thing clear before the presentation. Marijuana will still be banned on NIU's campus. Jeannie Meyer is the director of student conduct at NIU. She says that's mostly because of the Drug-Free Schools and Communities Act.
In order to receive federal funding, you know how some people get those wonderful loans from the federal government for school? In order for NIU to accept those, NIU has to agree that the use of cannabis on campus will be prohibited.
In recent years, the federal government has even issued more fines to institutions that have neglected the act. Rockford University is private, but it still has to adhere to that federal law.
It won't look radically different for us as a private university.
Randy Warden is the vice president for student life at RVU.
You have kind of competing interests. Federal government is very concerned that your schools are a drug-free environment, yet the states are allowing people to, you know, recreate with drugs that the federal government doesn't allow.
But both schools are turning their attention away from prevention and towards education. That's teaching students where cannabis is allowed, along with how to be as safe as possible if you choose to use it. For example, you cannot have it on university property, and that includes if your car is parked on campus. Meyer at NIU says you should also be aware of what's called constructive possession.
Which means if you have a pile of weed sitting in your residence hall room, and you obviously see it and it's close to you, you might be found responsible.
Meanwhile, at Rockford University, Randy Warden says enforcement will focus more on usage.
I don't think any longer we will be confiscating marijuana that we come across, because it's no longer an illegal substance. We're just saying you can't use it on our campus, and that'll be a distinction that students will have to get used to.
And if you do get caught on school property with cannabis, Meyer at NIU says the penalties are the same even if you're of legal age.
You could face a fine. You could be ordered to do a substance use program so that you understand the impact. It's very similar to how we treat underage drinking and also smoking.
From a law enforcement perspective, Jason John says there's a large range of penalties. He's the deputy chief of police operations for the NIU police. And violations may look different for non-NIU students, also known as non-affiliates, caught with cannabis.
Probably going to be referring to student conduct. For non-affiliates, I mean, we do have city ordinances. The DeKalb City has their certain ordinances that they have that we will probably issue to non-affiliates. With the decriminalization in Illinois, what that means for us is that our priorities are going to kind of shift in regards to public safety, education, and more of traffic safety.
Michael Zajac is the Associate Dean of Students in the Division of Student Affairs at NIU. He agrees the university mostly wants to focus on education.
We're not going to say, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that, it's bad. It's like, we just want to provide this health initiative.
He says the university is doing that through a communication plan. They updated their website to outline drug-related policies and provide an interactive map of where you can have cannabis. Their plan also includes wellness events like the Student Forum. Andrea Drott works in recreation and wellness. She says it's all about safety.
If somebody's getting stoned and not going to class, that's a bigger concern to me than if they're smoking and still succeeding academically and their health is still okay.
At Rockford University, administrators say they've seen an increase in marijuana use for the past several years. They're not certain how legislation will impact that trend, and that's why leaders say they would rather get the message out now before the law takes effect. I'm Peter Medlin.
It was mentioned that demand may outpace supply in the early days of the new marijuana law, and cultivators have been scrambling to prepare for the demand. Our reporter Dana Vollmer visited one central Illinois producer to see how preparation efforts are going.
So this is one of our genetics breeding rooms.
We're standing in a brightly lit room filled with shelves full of plants in the early stages of growth. Some are just inches tall. Growers are waiting for them to develop roots before they can be transplanted into larger pots.
So we are unique sort of as cultivators that we do a lot of our own strain breeding. So we'll take, you know, two strains of a plant and cross them with one another to develop new genetics.
Victoria Mendocino is chief of staff to the CEO of Revolution Cannabis, the largest producer of medical marijuana in Illinois. They're now one of 14 cultivators in the state approved to grow recreational cannabis. Mendocino is showing me around Revolution's main facility in Delavan, a town of just a couple thousand people, about a half an hour south of Peoria.
But you will see, though, with the genetic variation and diversity in strains, especially when they get further along in their life cycle, they really start to develop their own traits, different colors, different heights, different fan leaf size. Some of them are skinnier, some of them are fatter.
The plants move to different rooms as they grow closer to harvest. That process takes about 20 weeks. In one room, Mendocino shows me, there are at least 2,000 cannabis plants. It's hard to describe the vast space and the forest of greenery inside of it. To put it simply, it's a lot of pot. But growers say it's still not enough.
The fact is, there's so much demand in the market right now. We sell out of 100% of our product that we offer every single time we release it, which we release it weekly.
That's Revolution's COO, Dusty Schroyer.
And it's sold out within minutes.
And that's just with Illinois' medical cannabis users. What started as a pilot program was made permanent this summer, and the list of qualifying conditions expanded. On top of that, Schroyer says, applications for medical cards are processed more quickly.
That means that patients have been signing up for cards faster than we can actually build rooms and then grow the cannabis to bring it to market. It's about a two-year period. So whereas the market's doubled in size in the last year, it takes 2 years to actually build the rooms just to meet the demand.
Both Revolution and the state of Illinois say they have the same goal.
It's very important to us to protect the medical cannabis patients, period. End of sentence.
That's Governor J.B. Pritzker speaking at a press conference last week.
We also wanted to make sure that we're creating enough supply. And so 14 new adult use cannabis cultivation licenses have been granted so far. There will be more.
Part of the anticipation of January 1st, when adult recreational use becomes legal, is that there will be lines and shortages. Revolution CEO Mark D'Souza says this is something those in the industry have known since lawmakers drafted the legislation.
There is no way for any of us, any operator under the Illinois framework, to produce more at a higher rate to meet this demand, and we're all trying.
Revolution's current growing and processing facility is 75,000 square feet. Construction is underway to build a second identical space on the Delavan campus. They'll also build almost 500,000 square feet of greenhouses and another 20,000 square foot processing facility by 2022. For now, D'Souza says the supply chain to satisfy demand in Illinois simply is not there.
You know, it's very difficult for us to help consumers understand that we can't do it any faster.
And once the cannabis products go from Revolution's cultivation centers to dispensaries, it's up to those retailers whether they'll sell it for medical or recreational use. D'Souza says they hear loud and clear the concerns of patients as adult use recreational rolls out. That's why he supported home grow for medical users.
And that is one of the things that we feel is or could be very helpful in the short-term shortage.
Recreational users, in the meantime, are asked to taper their expectations and to be patient. I'm Dana Vollmer.
You're listening to Statewide, and we'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. Coming up, a new book chronicles the career of the late Illinois Congressman Lane Evans. We'll hear more about it. And a holiday audio postcard is also on the way. Now, a survey question. Would you say that most people can be trusted or that you can't be too careful? Illinoisans are divided. Brian Mackey takes a look at a recent set of survey results and asks why trust matters for democracy.
Americans have been asked about trust in one form or another for decades. The modern standardized version of the question goes like this. Generally speaking, would you say that most people can be trusted or that you can't be too careful in dealing with people? Nationally, just 32% of respondents say most people can be trusted. In Illinois, that figure is 39%.
So people are more trusting in Illinois as a whole than the nation as a whole.
This is John Transu, a professor of political science at the University of Illinois Springfield. He says back in the 1970s, the numbers on trust were relatively high, 46%, 44%. Then, in the 90s, it started declining.
And then the somewhat good news is that it leveled off. I mean, that we saw some really steep declines. But then in the late 2000s, it kind of leveled off at about 32%.
And nationally, that's basically where we are today. Line up any three Americans, and chances are one says most people can be trusted, while the other two are wondering, why are you lining us up, and who are you anyway? This question really piqued my curiosity. Public opinion surveys usually ask about politicians and issues. How's the governor doing? What do you think about immigration or gun control? So I asked Transu, why this trust question?
That's a great question, and it's actually one where there's a lot of work, and a lot of it began with a guy named Robert Putnam, who had a book called Bowling Alone.
America's social capital is diminishing, according to Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam.
NPR's Robert Siegel interviewed Putnam about bowling alone in the year 2000. The big metaphor in his book was that people were still going bowling, but that they were doing so in small groups, not through clubs or leagues.
Absolutely right. I'm using that as an example of the fact that we're no longer connecting with our communities.
It's this lack of connection that's key to the idea of social trust.
So when I just walk out my front door, what is my expectation? Do I need to be on guard? Or can I just sort of do what I'm meaning to do without thinking of how other people might thwart me or hurt me?
And if people are on guard about everyone they come across, that can be bad for our democratic self-governance.
We have to be able to interact with each other and believe that we can do so without, you know, undue repercussions. But even beyond that, it's a tremendous economic force. Not only do we see much higher growth rates and innovation in places with high trust, but also it seems to be a better predictor of future economic activity and success than even your previous economic activity, which is kind of mind-blowing.
If all this sounds a little abstract, here's a concrete example. Let's say there's a home renovation project. If it's in an area with higher trust, the workers can leave their tools out when they go to lunch. That saves time packing, locking in the truck. That sort of thing might be prudent in an area with lower trust, but it's time that's not being spent on productive and money-making construction. This conception of trust helps explain the biggest gaps when you drill down into the poll results. In the NPR Illinois survey, trust is one of the few areas where there aren't large gaps between Republicans and Democrats. But where you do see a divide is on race, income, education. Trust is markedly lower among people who are Black or Latino, who make less than $100,000 a year, or who have a high school diploma, maybe some college. The only groups that are more trusting than not are those with bachelor's degrees or who make more than $100,000 a year.
You can be more trusting if you could recover from a setback more easily. It's easier to go through life as a high trust person, but if you're one property loss away from not making rent, then you really can't do that. You have to be more careful.
In other words, for a lot of Americans, for a lot of Illinoisans, trust is a luxury they cannot afford. I'm Brian Mackey.
This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Former Illinois Congressman Lane Evans is the subject of a new biography. Devin Hansen of Rock Island says it took 8 years to compile, plus 2 more years to find a publisher to finally release Guts, the Lane Evans story, Herb Trix reports.
Hansen says he first got the idea in 2006, about the time Evans resigned from Congress due to the effects of Parkinson's disease.
And I first met Lane in 1983 when I was 8 or 9 years old, and I followed his career as a political junkie, you know, growing up. And he always kind of voted the way I would want a representative to vote. So I admired him a lot. And obviously he had a lot of celebrity around here. He helped so many people. So I thought, he has such a legendary status locally. I thought it would be nice to bring that story to a national audience.
He scoured back issues of local newspapers, interviewed friends and associates, and spent time with Elaine Evans' papers at Western Illinois University. Evans' father was a firefighter and his mother was a nurse, and Hansen says Evans never forgot where he came from.
His brothers said that, you know, politics were their sports. When they were around the dinner table, that's what they discussed. And, you know, Lane saw just how people, you know, especially in the early 80s with the recession and whatnot, how the working class was kind of getting shafted, and he identified with a lot of people due to his upbringing, like I said, and when he got into Congress, you know, for the first year, he was sleeping on the couch in his office, and he returned 10% of his salary. And he said that, you know, my constituents don't get these pay raises and these benefits, so why should I?
Reporters can remember the day after each election, very early on cold November mornings, seeing a lone figure outside factories in the Quad Cities. That was Evans spending hours shaking hands and thanking his supporters. And along with organized labor, some of his strongest supporters were farmers, but not all of them.
The farmers he kind of had a love-hate relationship with. He quit the Agricultural Committee after his first term, and I think that upset a lot of farmers. But throughout his career, he was always working for the small farmers, not the big agribusinesses. And that was something that a lot of people kind of didn't necessarily understand.
Lane Evans also focused his attention in Congress on helping veterans. He served in the Marine Corps during the Vietnam War.
One of his major accomplishments was for veterans. It was the Agent Orange Act of 1991. He worked for it for 10 years from the moment he got into office, but he met a lot of resistance from Sonny Montgomery and other people on the Veterans Affairs Committee. They didn't see Vietnam as the war. They saw World War II as the actual war. So Lane had a hard time fighting for all these benefits for the Vietnam vets. And finally in 91, he was able to co-sponsor it, and it was passed.
Barack Obama says of Lane Evans, "I wouldn't be president without you." That stemmed from Evans' involvement in the 2004 Democratic race for an Illinois seat in the U.S. Senate.
There were a lot of people running, and Obama struck him the most. You know, they had the most in common. They had the most similar viewpoints, and he saw the same guts within Obama that he had to vote his, political conscience rather than what was expedient. So he endorsed Obama when everybody was telling him not to. And so he stuck his neck out. Nobody else was endorsing him. He was the first notable Illinois politician to stick his neck out when everybody told him not to. And it just turned out to be the right decision.
Evans was first elected in 1982 and served until 2006 when he resigned due to the effects of Parkinson's disease. Hansen also chronicles Evans' final years.
I felt it was important for people to realize what Parkinson's is like. Hopefully it brings more awareness. Also, I think Lane would want people to know when he was in office with Parkinson's, he was still functioning. He was still working hard, and hopefully that gives inspiration to other Parkinson's patients that they can accomplish things too.
Lane Evans died on November 5, 2014, and is buried in the National Cemetery on Arsenal Island in the Quad Cities. I'm Herb Trix.
And again, the title of the book, Guts, The Lane Evans Story by Devin Hansen. It's published by Strong Arm Press. There's some new lighting and patched fencing around the abandoned Pillsbury Mills plant on the north end of Springfield. But some community members say more work needs to be done to make that area safe. Mary Hansen went on a perimeter walk with them and has this report.
Again, we've got the danger, asbestos signs.
Chris Richmond leads more than a dozen people down the sidewalk along 15th Street on the north border of the property.
And those are supposed to be posted every 100 feet or so around the perimeter.
Past the hulking structures that once were the Pillsbury Mills plant. Richmond is part of a community group that wants to see the structures torn down and the site cleaned up and redeveloped within 5 years. But that seems optimistic.
Just a little bit over a year ago. So on November,
we stop on the south end of the property.
An arsonist came onto the property and got into this warehouse here, this two-story warehouse, and set it on fire in multiple locations.
Richmond is familiar with the case. He's the former fire marshal for Springfield.
But again, it kind of gives you an idea of what kind of an attractant this is for bad elements and what can happen and then what the public cost can be.
He says so the longer the plant sits vacant, as it has since 2001, the more problematic it will be. The sighting and then death of a stray dog on the property over the summer sparked renewed interest in addressing the safety hazard. Still, some on the tour had fonder memories of the plant.
When I was a kid, it was like you could smell the bakery stuff, and they used to make stuff here. It was wonderful.
Rose Morris grew up in the neighborhood. She says she now worries about kids wandering onto the property and getting hurt.
Yeah, it's sad that we have to let this deteriorate to this point where, you know, it's bringing our neighborhood down, you know.
She thinks both the city and the current owners have a responsibility to clean it up. As for what could be there in the future, residents like Micah Miller are clear.
Definitely a business. The North End needs a little more vitality. If it's a grocery store, a lumber yard, you know, anything.
Miller is a member of the school board and represents the North End.
I think the great thing with this Pillsbury Mills neighborhood is if you have a great business that can employ people, it can help revitalize the whole community.
The Move Pillsbury Forward group has called on the city to take control of the property, which is privately owned. They say public ownership would make it eligible for federal and state grants that would bring in the millions of dollars needed for cleanup. But city officials have rejected the suggestion.
The city of Springfield does not have the capacity
it's going to take federal dollars, you know, state resources possibly, as much as possible. So that's what we're trying to move through that process.
That's Mayor Jim Langfelder. He says they're waiting on a pending court case against the current owner for help in getting the area secured. The owners removed some asbestos from the site without following proper safety procedures, which is illegal.
We don't have the authority to go on their property and do anything, but the courts could make a requirement that he'd have to put up security fencing. And in the case that he does not, or the entity does not, then the city be allowed to do so.
Back on the tour.
On this side, as many holes as we saw along the alley that have been mended up, there are more holes on this side of the fence where people are getting in.
Richmond shows how people are still getting onto the property, some to scrap metal and others just to look around. He then makes a pitch for what should happen next.
What we need to have is we need to have the city leadership working in concert with us on this and agreeing to a collective plan that we're all working toward, all working together toward.
I'm Mary Hansen.
American composer James Pierpont published One Horse Open Sleigh more than 160 years ago. Well, today that song is known by most everyone as Jingle Bells, and it became one of the most popular Christmas carols, even though Pierpont originally intended it for the Thanksgiving season. The song has been done in every style imaginable, yet its melody and lyrics are still instantly recognizable. Rich Egger heard many versions of Jingle Bells during the annual Dickens on the Square holiday celebration in downtown Macomb. He recorded them, talked to the artists, and produced this audio postcard.
Well, I'm Michael Murphy from Macomb, Illinois. It's just the way I picked up how to play music with a little bit of beat.
I'm president of Invoxicated, which is our a cappella group at Western Illinois University.
Jingle, 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 jingle. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Hey!
I'm Joshua Allen. I'm a guitarist from Macomb, Illinois.
Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way.
When I was a kid, it was one of the only memories I have of my grandpa when he used to play the steel guitar before he got Parkinson's. He played Jingle Bells, and we all were gathered around while he played, and so it's a special memory that I have of him.
Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Hello, my name is Dr. Jaron Hassan. I'm the new flute professor at Western Illinois University. So we're called the Macomb Flute Ensemble. The version that I found was for flute, solo flute, and piano accompaniment. And so I took each of the line, all of the chords, and I arranged it so that every person was playing a different part.
I'm John Graham, and I'm a member of Yule Kalele, a ukulele group. Jingle Bells is just a tradition that sticks in everybody's ears. Everybody knows it.
Jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
I'm Sandra Mosley from Macomb, Illinois. When I was a Girl Scout, we lived in a rural area, so it was possible for all of us to pile into this big hay wagon. When you're sitting on a hay wagon and you're looking at the backside of a horse, you know, that makes you giggle anyway if you're a kid. So we did a lot of giggling, but we always had the bells. And so Jingle Bells was the song that we would sing as we would go around this particular circle that we got to go around.
A Jingle Bells audio postcard from the annual Dickens on the Square holiday celebration in Macomb. Rich Egger produced that piece. We're glad you're with us on Statewide. There's more to come. Still ahead, a Springfield museum that tells the story of what it was like to travel Route 66 if you were African American. That's on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. Just ahead, how one Illinois school is addressing the issue of racial insensitivity. That and more still to come. Our next story is about a woman in the Chicago area. She often visits estate sales, and when she discovers an unfinished craft project, think cross-stitch or embroidery, she feels compelled to buy it and finish the work. She stumbled across an unfinished quilt of the United States this fall and says she knew she would need help to complete it, and she got it. Kate McGee tells us more.
Shannon Downey found the unfinished quilt in the bedroom of an old house on Chicago's north side. At that point, it was a pile of fabric cut into hexagons. A few were embroidered with the outline of a state, along with that state's bird and flower. Alaska and Georgia were finished. New Jersey was halfway done.
I just sat down and I started shaking my head, and my friends were standing around me and they're like, oh dear. And I was like, this feels much bigger than any of the other ones. And they're like, yeah.
The project was started by a woman named Rita. She died earlier this year at 99 years old. Downey's known on Instagram for blending art and activism under the name Badass Cross Stitch. And her friends are used to her buying these unfinished projects at estate sales.
99% of the time, it's an unfinished pillow or, you know, just a small hoop.
But she couldn't do this project alone. So she put a call out on Instagram. First step, getting the hexagons embroidered. The response was overwhelming. Women from across the country wanted in. Some researched Rita and found out she was a nurse and avid crafter. They found her high school yearbook photo. Whenever someone had a question, Downey thought about what Rita would want.
This is her art, and we're just the hands.
Next, she organized a modern-day quilting bee, carrying out a long tradition of women getting together to sew and quilt. Women came from all over the Midwest to help.
I'll start down Utah, West Virginia.
I'll do Texas, Washington, and 45.
The women sit chatting away, hunched over pieces of fabric, their needles and thread weaving in and out of the colorfully stitched hexagons.
So Wisconsin sticks sit here.
A few of the women sewing the quilt top together had also embroidered a state, including Hannah Allen, Elizabeth Foley, and Teresa Quaid. As they stitched, they discussed the project.
My work isn't worth somebody finishing when I die. No,
maybe
you could.
Yes, yeah. Maybe that's the whole point. Like, maybe Rita felt the same way too.
Like, it goes to a point of underappreciation of women's work, and we're kind of told that our work isn't worth anything.
Oh, it's just a little hobby.
Yeah, it's a hobby. It's a
like we underappreciate ourselves.
Yeah. Then. Ow. That was a pin in my palm.
As the women connected more and more pieces, Downey gathered them around.
I know that Rita is resting in craft peace because this is going to be done, and it's going to be done in a really epic way. Rita was just a normal person, and we're just normal people. It's wildly honorable, and it's worth there being artifact and story and memory around. So, yay, Rita.
Thank you, Rita.
Thank you, Rita. Thank you, Rita.
Cool.
7 hours after they started.
Last stitches. All right.
Oh, yeah, this is important.
The final thread.
Yay! Yay!
I'm going to cry. Oh, we made it.
The last stitchers stood in a circle, each holding an edge of the quilt top, nearly 8 by 9 feet. They admired their handiwork and the skill of so many other women, including Rita's, whose embroidery is now mixed in with the others. In March, the finished quilt will be on display at the National Quilting Museum in Paducah, Kentucky. I'm Kate McGee in Chicago.
You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. An unwanted spotlight is on some schools in West Suburban Naperville after a student allegedly made a racist Craigslist ad last month. Some parents and faculty say it's just the latest example of conduct that's been taking place there for years. District officials say they've been working to change this through rebuilding trust. Susie Yon with member station WBEZ explains.
Last year, Dr. Rakita Leakes was hired as Naperville School District 203's Executive Director of Diversity and Inclusion. Recently, she's been having to put out fires after the racist incident from Naperville Central High School went public.
That incident was just a reminder about how critical this work is.
A student was accused of posting an ad on Craigslist with a picture of a black student titled Slave for Sale. Many families of color say it's just one example of what's been going on in the district for years. They've asked administrators to hire someone like Leakes, and now they hope she'll use this moment to bring about meaningful change.
That's the angle in which I'm leveraging that particular incident, is to really think about, like, what can we do with students to make sure that they're culturally aware and culturally sensitive and that they're respecting each other.
It's a tall task, especially when some families doubt the district that has a black student population of 5% will ever change. Marla Baker moved with her children to Naperville from southern Illinois. She picked the community because she says on paper it looked like a great place to live and raise kids. But she remembers 3 years ago when she got a call from school that her son got in a fight with another middle school boy. She says her son got an in-school suspension while the other student was able to return to class. Baker says the school told her the other boy received a lesser punishment because he was just playing around.
So you call his behavior boys being boys, but you said what my son did was more aggressive. So you put him in school suspension. And that was kind of like the first time where there was a red flag to me that there might be some bias.
Then in eighth grade, her son was racially bullied over social media while at school during school hours.
There was a part of it where it was like, yo, you just need to kill yourself. And then they sent him pictures of a noose. They sent him pictures of the KKK.
Baker says they used a racial slur multiple times on the thread. She discovered the bullying and asked her son why he didn't tell anyone.
He's like, the last time I told somebody, I got in trouble and I was called aggressive. So I just felt like if I didn't say anything, it would go away.
Baker reported what happened to district officials. She says she tried to report it as a hate crime with the police, but was referred back to the school. Baker wanted to move her son to a different school, but she says the district discouraged it at first, saying it would be best if her son learned how to handle these kinds of problems. The district has 22 schools and serves more than 16,000 students. Baker says her son started questioning his worth, and now that he's in high school, she says he's withdrawn, and it made her question her parenting.
There are some days that I cry because I feel helpless, and I feel powerless, and I feel like I can't do anything.
Black parents and students aren't the only ones feeling discouraged by the administration. Brandy McClinton, who is black, worked at a Naperville elementary school in 2017. She heard staff make comments that implied working with students of color was like working with animals. She remembers discussing with a colleague how to respond to a young girl who said she calls black people chocolate ice cream. The colleague didn't think there was anything wrong with that, and in fact, she said she called black people Tootsie Rolls.
We already had a discussion about her calling black people Tootsie Rolls, that it would have changed, because I believe that if people are saying something out of ignorance and they don't know it's offensive, it's one thing, but once you inform somebody that that's an offensive statement and they continue it and they're an adult, that's not acceptable.
McClinton says she had to take on tasks that weren't part of her job description, like collecting forms and handling discipline for black students. She was also asked to make calls to black parents. Many times she had no previous connection with these families.
But with administration, it was more the parents lacking the skills to communicate with them is how they portrayed it.
McClinton says her attempts to report these things were dismissed, and she said she faced retaliation for raising them. After one semester, she left.
I went to counseling after that because it was emotionally damaging. And I wasn't going to ruin my career over them, and I wasn't going to continue to get depressed over them.
The district would not respond to questions about Baker and McClinton's specific incidents for privacy reasons. But Dr. Leek says she recognizes the district has done things in the past that validate their concerns.
Maybe the perception is that's out there is that it had not been a priority in the past, but I want to make it clear to them that it is a priority right now.
More than 90% of teachers in Naperville are white. Dr. Leek says in the past, it's likely staff did not recognize they had blind spots when it came to race. If they've never experienced racism or implicit bias, it may be easy to dismiss something as an isolated incident. Leek says that's why it's important for the community to recognize the pain and burden people of color have endured.
We can heal together, and we can find some resolution in how to move forward and to address those situations appropriately.
Leek has laid out a plan for immediate priorities that includes a curriculum audit and deep equity trainings for staff. She's also looking at how to change hiring practices to increase diversity. Parents like Carrie King are hopeful. She says her daughters have dealt with racial bias at school, though not as severe as what Baker's son experienced. She says under Leeks, things were moving in the right direction, but very slowly. She says the district has been a powder keg, and what happened at Naperville Central High School sparked the explosion. She hopes that that public backlash will accelerate change.
We have been asking for that level of accountability for some time. Now they're in a position where they're going to have to show some level of accountability because all eyes are watching.
Susie Ahn, WBEZ News.
Springfield hosts an annual Route 66 Mother Road Festival, which celebrates classic cars, music, and food along the historic highway. But there's more to the story. Route History, a souvenir shop and museum, opened in Springfield this year to highlight contributions of black-owned businesses in the city along Route 66 during the Jim Crow era. Daisy Contreras spoke to owners Stacy Grundy and Gina Lathan about their goal to bring back history that is not always celebrated.
That was also during the time of Jim Crow, so it dictated where black people could live, where they could eat, where they could get gasoline.
Stacy Grundy is the co-owner of Route History. She leads a group of local residents through a tour of the Route 66 experience from a black perspective. She points to old black and white photographs posted around the souvenir shop's walls, depicting barbershops and storefronts.
So in response to Jim Crow, black businesses increased. Because black people, we still needed services. We still were on the road. And then our travel had to be so strategic because it could really be life or death if you stop in the wrong towns.
When one thinks of Route 66, we think of rock and roll and family road trips. But for black travelers, that experience was very different. It was one where their safety depended on trusted connections along the way. Grundy says the idea to add an interactive tour came from discussions with co-owners Gina Lathan and Kenneth Lockhart. Gina Lathan says the goal is to increase awareness.
And as African Americans, especially for myself, one who was born and raised here in Springfield, I understood that there is definitely a rich history in the city of Springfield, as well as that I knew about, but that many people didn't know about. And I didn't know a lot of the interesting facts and historic events as well.
Some of that history revolves around the many black businesses and homes that opened up along Route 66 and around Springfield to welcome African-American travelers. In her tour to visitors, Grundy explains the importance of the Green Book, a guide for those travelers. It gave tips on lodging and restaurants African-Americans could safely visit.
Because based on the color of your skin, a certain mechanic might not repair your car. Gas station, something as simple as gas was racialized. And so Springfield was one of those safe spaces.
That history is often not taught in local schools. Lathan says she's seen some improvement with more classrooms incorporating those historical facts.
But there's still a lot of work to do, and we're really excited about being able to be a part of the progress of introducing all children, as well as adults, into the rich history and oftentimes the untold stories of the contributions of black people.
The team has created a curriculum, one where it's not necessary for kids to visit the souvenir shop. Grundy and Lathan have partnered with community organizations to connect with kids and their teachers. Lathan says this approach teaches more than just history. She says it teaches pride.
Allowing an opportunity for many young people to connect with very positive role models that have done great things in the past, and many of the things that they've done, many of the young people may be discouraged and kind of felt like that's not something that they could have done, such as starting a business.
Both women say the response to the curriculum and the souvenir shop, which sells t-shirts, magnets, and pencils, has been positive. Local resident Daryl Triggs took the 20-minute history route experience tour one afternoon. Triggs says he's lived in Springfield for about a decade and is learning about the Green Book for the first time.
And that's interesting because I've traveled and still travel, and you still experience certain things when you're traveling. So I can't even imagine in that time as an African-American, a black person, traveling from Illinois to California without having something to refer to.
Looking back, Lathan says she's proud of what she and her business partners have accomplished in just a few months.
No, it's hard work. It's hard work, but it's the type of work that if we could do it for free, we would, and we pretty much have been giving of our time. But we definitely like the idea of young girls looking and seeing that we are business owners, we are professionals, and we definitely like to give back to our community.
The trio plan to donate some of the shop's earnings to help restore local buildings, especially those that helped African-American travelers along their journey. I'm Daisy Contreras.
That wraps up Statewide for this week. We're glad you could be with us. Don't forget to join us again next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. All of our episodes can be found at statewideshow.com, and our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.